Okay, now start talking.
The day in March 1933 that the new managing board of the Columbia Daily Spectator was to be announced, I was called in by the Associate Dean of Columbia College, Nicholas McKnight, M-C-K-N-I-G-H-T, and told that I was being declared ineligible for campus activities. I was astounded. I said, why? Because you failed to pass your French oral course. I was even more astounded. So I remonstrated and said, in the first place, it's a one-point course. In the second place, it's not the final grade, it's a midterm. And midterm grades can be changed. And he said, we're doing this for your own good. And I was absolutely heartbroken because everybody knew I was going to be editor of the Columbia Spectator. But the administration was determined to stop it. So I went back to the office and I told the outgoing editors what had happened. They were waiting to hear why I was being called to the dean's office. The editor at that time was Arthur J. Lelyveld, whose son, Joe Lelyveld, became executive editor of the New York Times. Anyway, I told the managing board that I'd been declared ineligible for flunking a midterm, not a final exam, in dictée, which is what it was.
Do you want some water?
Yeah, hold it. Stop it.
So it'll stop if we fly. Ice?
No need. So I went back to the managing board and told them that I'd been declared ineligible. And they asked me why, and I told them what McKnight had said, that I had flunked at midterm a one-point course in French dictée. And they all looked at each other and they said, okay, leave. And I left the office. And suddenly, the whole managing board, these are all seniors, all managing board came out of the office, their secret office, their hidden office. And they walked out together, and we didn't know why. And they walked down to Hamilton Hall, which is where the dean's office was. And I was just sitting there contemplating, you know, whether to eat glass, broken glass, in some way to commit suicide. Not seriously, but I was pretty desperate. And I just sat there. They came back and said nothing. Suddenly I got a phone call in the office of the Columbia Spectator. The dean would like to see you at his house, which was around the corner from Columbia, at 7 o'clock. So I told them, and they all looked at each other and said nothing.
How many of them were there?
Four. Uh-huh. An editor, managing editor, and two assistant managing editors.
What were their names?
Lelyveld, Hazlitt, Garten, G-A-R-T-E-N, and I forget who the other one was. Mm-hmm. but it's easy to find on the masthead.
Yeah.
And so at 7 o'clock, I went, and then the whole manager board went to the dean's office about 4 or 5 o'clock. And they came back and said nothing. And so I waited till 7. I went over to the dean's office, to the dean's house, around the corner on Morningside Avenue. And the long and short of it, he was declaring me eligible and taking away the suspension. And
did he explain why?
We had done it for your own good, you know, I don't remember why, because I was too much in shock.
Right.
And a year later, I discovered what had happened.
Uh-huh.
And that was when the four guys on the managing board heard I'd been suspended for flunking this one-point course at midterm, not a final grade. They went to the dean and said, was it true that I was being suspended? Yes. Well, they said, then we'll have to publish tomorrow's paper that the captain of the football team, Steve Grender, has not yet passed freshman English. Blackmail. That finished that.
Why have they been sitting on that for so long?
Well, you don't want to, you know, it's not...
But they had it ready.
But, you know... If he's suspended...
Very interesting. Yeah.
That's how I became editor.
That's a great story. So, let's see, what else is here?
But, you know, you got to think of it, it's an amazing... You got the tape going?
Yeah.
See, I was not the first Jew to be editor of the Columbia Spectator.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Lelieveld was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a member of a fraternity.
Uh-huh.
In my case, it was a great achievement because I was not a member of a fraternity. I was an independent, as it was called, and a Jew, and not even a high-class Jew, but a Yid from the
mm-hmm.
East Side.
Mm-hmm.
So to have been elected, you know, mm-hmm. editor... was really quite something. And so the point is that I was a Jew with no connections on the campus. Every editor of the Spectator before me had been a member of a Greek fraternity, you know, Greek letter fraternity. I was the first one. No connections. So to that extent, it was an achievement because what the dean's office didn't want is a Jew, naturally a radical, and an independent, which would hurt the fraternity because the editor of the Spectator was regarded as a job for a fraternity man.
Why?
Historically.
I've never
more conservative, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Just tradition. Really? Tradition!
Uh-huh.
And here was a guy with no fraternity whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
a Jew, and a low-class Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And see, it couldn't be that anti-Semitic because one of the important members of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University was Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, the then publisher of the New York Times. And Butler himself was no way anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was almost philo-Semitic.
Butler was president then?
Yeah, he was the president.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I met him, when I was at a Spectator, I met him, he told me a story to ingratiate himself
mm-hmm.
with me.
Mm-hmm.
He said he had been, made a speech in Toronto, and at the end of the speech, a minister came up to him and said, President Butler, is it true that you have men on your faculty who do not believe in Jesus Christ? And Butler said, yes. And the minister said, can you give me their names? I could write to them and bring them back to Christ. He said, sure. And I gave him the names. Lionel Trilling, Maya Shapiro, and Irwin Edmund. You know who they are.
Let's say who they are.
Well, Lionel Trilling was then professor of English literature. Maya Shapiro was professor of art, history, and Irwin Edmund was professor of philosophy.
I don't know. I've never heard of Irwin Edmund. How do you know his last name?
E-D-M-A-N.
Uh-huh.
In fact, you might pick up his books. He was a very amusing writer.
Really?
Yeah, very nice guy. He was an albino.
Really?
Yeah. And he looked at you from the sideways because he couldn't look directly at you. But he has a number of books to his credit, and one of them is fairly light, you know, reading. And he was a good philosopher. He specialized in aesthetics.
Oh. Sounds interesting. So why didn't you join a fraternity? No money?
Big money.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not big, but big to me.
Right, yeah.
Didn't have any money. Well, you don't join, you're asked to join. You don't apply for membership.
Right, but you must...
They have what they call Rush Week.
Right. But you didn't participate in that? Or were you? Did you...
I had no interest in it.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it cost money. Mm-hmm. Look, I was living, at one point, when I was a freshman, on 25 cents a day.
Mm-hmm.
A nickel car fare. Mm-hmm. And that's 10 cents up and back. And an apple for a nickel. During the Depression, we had apple sellers, the way of selling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 15 cents. And what I ate was, I applied to be a waiter in the dining halls.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to get a little bit of a meal, but we stole off the plates You see, you got to remember, the Depression is like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was stuck that way. That is, it wasn't, you had the very rich guys and so on. We were all, you know, and everybody lived by his wits, so to speak. And I remember being very unhappy because we went out Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
You could go, there was a chain of restaurants called Child's. And you could, for 50 cents, eat all you want. But during the Depression, they had restaurants which you could put in and eat all you want. And you used to eat. Then we used to be able to make lemonade. And the automat, did you ever see the automat?
I used to go to the automat.
Well,
you open the little boxes and you take out the food.
Well, we used to go and make lemonade because the water was free.
Mm-hmm.
And they had slices of lemon for the tea, which we could take. And the sugar was with them.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go in there and make lemonade. No, the Depression was... money was so important. The car fare, to get to Columbia, we lived on the east side. The subway that took you was the west side.
Mm-hmm.
So I either would walk 15 blocks to get the west side subway, or I could take a streetcar to take me to the subway. That was a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
A nickel was very big money.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd get up a half hour earlier to walk to the west side subway. Because I could go on the east side subway, but it was too far. It was a walk to get to the east side subway.
I see. It was a walk, you mean, from the east side subway to Columbia then?
No, I walked from my home on Eldridge Street.
Uh-huh.
All the way down to the west side subway stop.
Yeah, yeah.
Which took a half hour at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15 blocks is almost a mile. Yeah.
Carrying a suit, you know, a satchel too. A briefcase.
A briefcase with your books. Oh, you used to use a briefcase to take
Yeah, and they didn't have backpacks then.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't your mother ever try to give you sandwiches to take for lunch or something?
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
She may have, you know, I just...
But if you were working as a waiter at the halls, maybe she didn't need to.
But that was at night.
Oh, I see.
But then I got a job as a copy boy in the Herald Tribune.
Uh-huh.
You know, how I survived all that is incredible. I'd get up in the dawn.
Mm-hmm.
First I used to put on tefillin, but then I gave that up.
When did you give that up?
I know it's about when I started going to Columbia. Mm-hmm. But you started filming when you were 13.
Yeah. So you used to pray every morning when you went to Columbia?
Yeah.
How long did
before,
it take?
15 minutes. Uh-huh. No, when I was by mitzvah, for several years, I would say at least 3 years every morning, except on Saturday.
On your own or with your father?
You prayed on your own.
So where was your father? Where would he pray?
He had already gotten up earlier.
Oh, I see.
He got up early every morning to read Psalms, uh-huh. which he by that time he knew him by heart.
Right.
And you know, it's amazing when you think of it, the amount of time devoted. You know, you didn't have, you know, taxis to take and things like that. Mm-hmm. Walked all the way down on the West Side subway, and then try to get there in time for the 9 o'clock, your 9 o'clock class, mm-hmm. and do homework, and then go down to the Herald Tribune to work as a copy boy, mm-hmm. and then they worked it out for me very nicely. The Herald Tribune was on 40th Street, and I would deliver copy. My last errand would be to deliver copy. In those days, they didn't have fax machines and so on. And either the Tribune had a syndicate, so they sold their stories. So either a guy read it to a guy down at the Buffalo Courier Express, let's say.
I mean, read it over the phone.
Over the phone. Mm-hmm. And the other guy typed it as he was reading. And this was a job. Mm-hmm. And or else, see, by telegraph, it would cost money and take time. It's cheaper to do it on the phone. Mm-hmm. But then at the very end of the evening, there'd be some stuff which had come in after the guy got home. So I would be given this copy, which would be typed up, and to deliver it. You know Park Row? You know where City Hall is in New York?
It's all the way downtown.
That's Park Row. And the Buffalo Courier Express had an office there, so I would leave. I would deliver the copy to them. And then, this now being almost midnight, I would then do something you wouldn't dare do today. Mm-hmm. I would walk from City Hall mm-hmm. to my home on Eldridge Street. Mm-hmm. You know, almost midnight. Mm-hmm. You know, just walk along, unconcerned. There was no way to take a streetcar, because mm-hmm. there was streetcar didn't come anywhere near.
How long did it take to walk?
Oh, about 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I'd get home, go to bed, and up at dawn.
Really, at dawn?
Well,
like 6 a.m. or something?
Get up at 7.
7.
Because I'd have to. When I stopped saying prayers, I got up at 7:30.
So when you stopped saying prayers, was that a conscious decision?
What?
When you stopped saying prayers, was that like a conscious decision?
Very conscious.
How did it come about?
I just, one day didn't.
And what was the...
When I graduated from high school, in those days you could graduate in the winter term as well. So I was through at school in January. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't start Columbia until September. So I had all this time, so I found...
But you knew that you had been accepted at Columbia already?
Not yet that time. Okay. I got accepted at Columbia in a very interesting way. I was called up for an interview. And I'd been out about 3 or 4 months from January. And I was an avid newspaper reader. So among the questions he gave me, one of them was, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee? So I said, Senator William E. Borah. Amazing. You know, who would know that? A kid? Then he said, could you explain to me Einstein's theory of relativity? Well, it just happened that I just read Bertrand Russell's book, The ABC of Relativity. Mm-hmm. So I knew more than the questioner. Mm-hmm. And I began smiling and goes, okay, that's enough. I think that's how I got in. Yeah. But I did something else. Heywood Broun wrote a book with another guy. You can even might get it on Amazon.
I have it.
Christians Only?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote him a letter. Mm-hmm. See, in the book he talks about the numerous classes mm-hmm. at Columbia. Mm-hmm. So I wrote him a letter. He was then a columnist. Uh-huh. And saying, I read your book, Christians Only. And I'm a victim of the numerous classes, I think. So could you help me get into Columbia by writing a letter in my favor? Mm-hmm. I got in. I don't know whether he did it or didn't do it, but I got in to Columbia. And there was nobody else. It was such an achievement that the principal of my high school, Robert Brody, wrote me and asked me, would I come in and talk to the students, the graduating class, because the idea that, I was the first one to get into Columbia. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that did. I don't know if anybody applied, but there were no Columbia students graduating from Seward Park High School.
That's where you went, Seward Park High School.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Named after William H. Seward, who was Secretary of State in Lincoln's time, and was the guy who bought Alaska.
Oh, really?
For $8 million. Huh. One of the greatest investments ever made.
I just think it's such a shame not to get your expression when you're doing this. That I'm trying
not what?
Not to get your expression when you're talking like this. Oh. That's what I'm trying to see if I can put the tripod on. But probably I won't be able to do it.
So the way to do it is to go back to start it, forget it. Close the tripod. Close it. Now try to put it in.
You're right.
Did you make it tight enough?
I don't know. Oh, but this way? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. This is really cute, isn't it? Let's see if it... Open this. Is it open?
It's not even. Make sure the legs are rolling.
That's open, right? Yeah, but it's not high enough.
It's not what?
It's not high enough. It's missing the top of your forehead, so it has to be on something higher.
Will those legs pull out? The legs will pull out.
You're very good. Well, you should be. This is your occupation. Let's see. But now, I can choose, huh? The height of it.
Would you like that calendar? I'm not going to use it.
Yeah, sure. I like calendars. I collect them. Now, this is perfect. I wish you could see yourself. Can I leave it like this? Do you think I? Oh, this has to be tighter here. Ay, ay, ay. Oh, shit. Let me do this. Okay, anyway, so go on.
Where was I? I don't remember.
William Seward High School. No one, it was so unusual for someone to go to Columbia from your school.
So I was, the principal asked me, how I'd done it and so on. Uh-huh. But it was an achievement to get him because, in fact, I was the only kid on the east side at Columbia.
Really? I just want to move this so it's not...
They just didn't apply first. It took money.
Uh-huh.
And I convinced my father that the tuition, believe it or not, was $300 a year. God knows what it is now. $20,000 a year?
20 or 30. It's going up every year. Yeah. But to go back to the prayer thing, I'm interested in that, how you stopped. How you stopped praying.
I don't know how I stopped.
But you said it was conscious, that you just, you know, decided one day.
It wasn't one day, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember. I remember the violations. I remember eating on Yom Kippur.
Uh-huh.
But see, I feel very sorry for my father. He was lost. And I, you know, here he was living in a shtetl for him.
Mm.
Where he was a shtetl.
Right.
The store was here and the synagogue was there. And for him, nothing had changed.
Yeah.
And here's me rebelling.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, not rebelling, just refusing to have any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing you've done about it. Mm-hmm. Couldn't throw me out of the house.
But it
must have been very tough on him.
But, you know, it's interesting because in the diary that you wrote, what is it called? Acta Diurna? Remember the diary you wrote? What was it called? I have it.
Daily Doings.
Yeah. You described the day when you were looking for a job, and the only job you could get was a job that you had to work on Saturday.
Yeah, and I got it.
Yeah. And so you were worried that your father was going to say something. But then you recorded, he didn't say anything, I went off to work, was okay. You know, so I saw the exact moment when you began to separate from that. And that was very interesting.
But I'd separated a long time before.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It wasn't immediate in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. What are these letters you talked about? This thing?
Yeah.
What are they about? What
I have
letters?
A bunch of letters. You can look at them. I don't know.
Sure, okay. You didn't give them to the Hoover, obviously.
No.
Yeah. And so what is this thing about your pacifism when you were editor of Spectator? I'm going to find... That's why I have
these
editorials.
There's an editorial which I marked.
You marked for me?
Yeah, it's folded in.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So what about it? What's the question?
Well, were you a pacifist? And if so, when and why? And how did you stop being a pacifist?
Well, we were the anti-war generation.
Uh-huh.
We didn't want to become the pre-war generation.
What do you mean? The generation before the next war?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so we were very much influenced by the Oxford Oath. That was a pledge undertaken at Oxford by Oxford students, which is something like, I will not fight for king or country, 1933. And it spread all over the U.S. And so we called an anti-war conference. You'll find that referred to in the editorials. Well, no, the Social Problems Club I was a member, I was elected a member of the student board, and asked us to participate in their anti-war conference.
The student board of what? You were a member of the student board of Columbia?
Of Columbia College.
I see.
The students elected.
I see.
And I was elected, one of the others elected. Mm-hmm. By a big majority, mm-hmm. as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So,
this just stopped.
The Social Problems Club, which was the communist YCL.
This just stopped by itself, so I'm just turning it off. I'm not going to fool around with it.
So how are you going to record it?
Oh, it's recording here.
Oh. the YCL, Social Problems Club, mm-hmm. came to us as student board mm-hmm. asking for their endorsement, mm-hmm. for our endorsement mm-hmm. of their anti-war conference. Mm-hmm. So being a genius, I proposed that we call the anti-war conference mm-hmm. and we take it over. Mm-hmm. And we did, and I became the chairman of the student board committee to arrange invitations mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. And we had an anti-war conference. In those days, being anti-war was the chic thing to do. Everybody was against war, mm-hmm. except the communists. Mm-hmm. When we had our anti-war conference, they learned the power of the communists.
When you had the anti-war conference?
We called an anti-war conference.
Yeah, yeah, and?
To refer to.
Right.
And we had a resolution mm-hmm. which called for no support for any war. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there's an amendment. Mm-hmm. Except for wars of colonial liberation. Oh. Where did that happen? You know, who watched colonial liberation? What are we talking about, you know? But that was the party line. Uh-huh. So we had posed it, said it's nonsense, either you're for or against, and so on. They called for a vote, overwhelmingly defeated. Uh-huh. Of course, the communists had packed it. Mm-hmm. You know, the credentials committee, anybody could have come in and said, I'm a student at the teacher's college.
Oh, uh-huh.
So nobody asked, let's see, it could, you know, if they did, you could pass it on to somebody else, you know.
There was no credentials committee, you're saying, or there was?
What?
You said there was a credentials committee?
Oh, yeah.
And so people had to go present their credentials
yeah.
to them? So did they have fake credentials? Or they just said, I am?
You know, who could believe, you know,
right.
that they came there and they right. voted overwhelmingly mm-hmm. for opposition to all wars except wars of colonial liberation. mm-hmm. Oh, boy. That's when I learned the power of organization.
So when did you stop being a pacifist?
Hitler, I think, influenced us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Hitlerism and fascism, and I really wasn't a pacifist, it wasn't a thought-out position, you know, mm-hmm. of pacifism. Just anti-war.
Uh-huh.
But Hitler changed a lot of opinions.
Well, when was that? I mean, how about the Spanish Civil War? Didn't that change opinions?
That came later. That's 1937.
Yeah, so when is Hitler?
1933.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't very long then that you went through this pacifist period. I mean, I thought that Hitler changing people from pacifists would have been later, like 37, 38.
You know, right.
So in 33, did people really realize how terrible he was?
No.
So then how could Hitler have changed you from a pacifist position in 33?
Well, because I'm smarter.
I see, okay. You know, okay. So as you're looking over your editorials, can you see an actual change in your position?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But it certainly wasn't pacifism. We were opposed to war, mm-hmm. and Hitler was separated.
I see.
He didn't come into the picture because it was 33.
Uh-huh.
Germany right. was still a weakened country. There was
right.
no real army there. You know, uh-huh. Uh-huh. It was by the see you begin to worry about Hitler. That is the average person. When Hitler marched into the Rhineland in 1933. Mm-hmm. which was then French-occupied mm-hmm. and took it away, mm-hmm. restored it. It was German territory, but the French were occupying it, mm-hmm. or could have occupied it, but it was not, and he walked in and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was when we realized the problem that Hitler presented.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, So you're saying that you weren't a pacifist, but
I was not, really.
Yeah, because you said my own pacifism. I could have written like Akiko. It's very interesting because Akiko also is not a pacifist, but I think she had the same feeling that you had, you know, to some extent.
I think you ought to go. What time is it now?
Oh, I can go to the thing. Yeah.
Get squared away so we can have
it. Right.
Now.